Can I, first of all, welcome if you're coming online. It's good to see you. Thanks for joining us. I want to start with some history. Is that okay? Who can tell me 1517? What happened in the year 1517 that's very important for Christianity? Very significant event in the history of Christianity. Anyone? Yes. The Reformation. Boom. There we go. See, we got Colleen knows. Yeah. Martin Luther delivers his 95 theses and says, hey, I got some things I want to talk about. Not super aggressive at first. He's like, I got to talk about some things. And of course, it escalates and turns into what we know as the Protestant Reformation, when many people in the church broke away from the Roman Catholic Church and became new denominations. It was a big deal, to say it understatedly. And we're still living where this is a Protestant church. But something happened in the years following the Protestant Reformation. A couple things. So we're talking like, you know, century-long kind of trends. One of the things was called scholasticism, Protestant scholasticism, where people were just really, really interested in getting it right. Like, we want to make sure, because there were a number of theological concerns in the Reformation, say, hey, we don't agree with this. We actually, this is what we believe. And so then they kept going, okay, how do we articulate that more clearly, more precisely? And they kept going kind of, yeah, we want to articulate these truths very, very clearly. And at the same time, in those same centuries following the Reformation, there was a lot of war that started between countries that were associated with different religious groups. They called the Wars of Religion, the European Wars of Religion. And so there's these different countries, Catholic countries, Protestant countries, and they start warring against each other. And there's religious aspects mixed in with political, national aspects, and you have all this kind of nasty stuff happening that kind of leaves a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. But kind of in the middle of this scene, this movement started in Germany called Pietism. And Pietism said, wait a second, I think we're missing something. Like all of this kind of scholastic pursuit of clarity and articulating these truths well, and then we've got all these wars happening. Like, isn't the message of Jesus actually about how we live? And isn't it actually about our as people, as individuals, our devotion to God? And is it actually about how we live towards one another? And the movement of Pietism was incredibly influential, carrying through the Great Awakenings in the following centuries, and hugely influential in the stream of Christianity that we live in today, evangelicalism. And so, beautiful. And so we're going to look at 1 Timothy today. It's a letter that the Apostle Paul wrote to kind of his apprentice, Timothy. And I feel like I can see some parallels. It seems like Paul, when he's writing to Timothy, and Timothy's in Ephesus, there's some people in Ephesus who have maybe a similar focus on these kind of theoretical concerns. They're so caught up in these controversies, these debates. But while they focus on that, just kind of like maybe the pursuit of war is taken up by Protestant Christians in the 16th and 17th centuries. So in Ephesus, when the practical calls of Christianity were neglected because they were so focused on this kind of theoretical stuff, then a different pursuit, a different practical pursuit takes the place of the pursuit of Jesus. And in this case, it's the pursuit of wealth. So let's read in 1 Timothy 6. We'll start just at the very end of verse 2 because sometimes the verses get it wrong as far as where to divide. And anyway, or maybe it's right, but I'm going to start with this, where Paul says, teach and urge these duties. I think it's just helpful for what goes on. And then continuing in verse 3, whoever teaches otherwise and does not agree with the sound words of our Lord Jesus Christ and the teaching that is in accordance with godliness is conceited, understanding nothing, and has a morbid craving for controversy and for disputes about words. From these come envy, dissension, slander, base suspicions, and wrangling among those who are depraved in mind and bereft of truth, imagining that godliness is a means of gain. Of course, there is great gain in godliness combined with contentment, for we brought nothing into the world so that we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with these. But those who want to be rich fall into temptation and are trapped by many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. And in their eagerness to be rich, some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pains. But as for you, man of God, shun all this. Pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, endurance, and gentleness. So as I kind of mentioned, this letter is the first of two letters that we have that the Apostle Paul wrote to Timothy. Timothy was kind of Paul's apprentice. He was a pastor and also like an overseer of pastors. He's kind of a church planter or a part of a church planting movement in Ephesus where, you know, Paul was ministering there and Timothy's there and Timothy's setting up, you know, local church leadership as he's in Ephesus. And in his letter, this first letter of Paul to Timothy, he encourages Timothy. Timothy's relatively young. He says, you know, keep going, keep doing the ministry. Don't be timid. God's given you a spirit of power. Live into the gift that God's given you and continue to fight the good faith, which is personal encouragements. And alongside those there's a number of instructions about the church in Ephesus, including the appointment of local church leaders, the care of widows, and instructions for people from different walks of life on how to live Christianly in this walk of life that you find yourself in. And the passage we've read comes near the end of the letter after many of these instructions have been given. And so Paul's instructions teach and urge these duties. That points back to what he's already said. Okay, these are the things that the church in Ephesus needs to pursue. So teach and urge these duties. And it's an important encouragement because as Paul goes on, we see that there's different kinds of teaching going on. And teaching has two components. We're talking about this in our class on Wednesday. So we run some Bible school courses in the church called the Church Ministry School. We meet on Wednesdays, and so we're doing a doctrine course. And we're talking about this idea of, you know, teaching isn't just this theoretical thing. Ideas, as I heard someone say, ideas have street value. There's two components to teaching, and Paul certainly would see this. There's truth claims. Hey, this is what's true. And then there's kind of like life claims, claims on our lives. What does this mean for how we live? There's a lifestyle associated with the truth claims. And so you can see this in what Paul writes. Read again in verse 3. Whoever teaches otherwise and does not agree with the sound words of our Lord Jesus Christ and the teaching that is in accordance with godliness is conceited, understanding nothing, and has a morbid craving for controversy and for disputes about words. From these come envy, dissension, slander, base suspicions, and wrangling among those who are depraved in mind and bereft of the truth, imagining that godliness is a means of gain. So you can kind of see that these two things are put side by side. There's the sound words of Jesus, and there's the teaching that is in accordance with godliness, a lifestyle. And on the other hand, there's different teaching, a lack of truth, and this whole slew of evil behaviors, right? Envy, dissension, slander, etc. And this Greek word eusebia, or it's translated godliness, is kind of a key term through all of this. It refers to piety, which is maybe a word we don't use a lot, but devotion, maybe an easier way to say it would be like devotion to God. We want to be devoted to God and our lives. We want to know him and we want to live in accordance with his way. For Paul, this devotion to God is kind of the end that all the teaching leads to. The sound words of Jesus lead to a life devoted to God. Paul wants Timothy to teach the truth about God and what living for him looks like so that people would know him and serve him and live in devotion to him. And it seems that the other people in Ephesus that Paul's referring to had kind of lost sight of that end. They're very interested in the theoretical questions. They love the debates. But in their debating, they've lost sight of the teaching of Jesus and the godliness, the devotion to God that goes along with it. And for Paul, that's a clear indicator that they've lost sight of the truth as well. He says a similar thing at the beginning of his letter. This is kind of how he starts it, verse 3 of chapter 1, 1 Timothy. I said that in a really weird order. Anyway, you know, 1 Timothy 1, 3, and onward. I urge you, he says to Timothy, as I did when I was on my way to Macedonia, to remain in Ephesus so that you may instruct certain people not to teach any different doctrine, just teaching, and not to occupy themselves with myths and endless genealogies that promote speculations rather than the divine training that is by faith. But the aim of such instruction is love that comes from a pure heart, a good conscience, and a sincere faith. Some people have deviated from these and turned to meaningless talk, desiring to be teachers of the law without understanding either what they're saying or the things about which they make assertions. The aim is love. The sound words accord with godliness. But for the people that Paul's referring to, those practical ends have been neglected. The sound words of Jesus are replaced with speculation and controversy, and godliness and love are replaced with envy, dissension, slander, and suspicion. But it gets even worse. Godliness has not only been neglected and made way for all of these behaviors, but godliness has actually been replaced. Devotion to God isn't the aim anymore. Instead, devotion to God actually becomes a means to a different end, Paul says. Again in verse 5, they imagine that godliness is a means of gain. And as we read further, it becomes clear that it's material gain, wealth, that's the driving factor. So there's obviously lots we don't know. Like when we read a letter like this, there's lots we don't know about what's happening in Ephesus with this group of people. We don't know exactly who they were or how their pursuit of wealth interacted with their speculations. But it's evident that their neglect of a kind of whole life-encompassing teaching of Jesus has left them with a teaching that doesn't necessitate a life that's lived out in devotion to God, and it leaves a gap to be filled. They're not pursuing this practical end. What are they pursuing instead? Because we always have some practical end that our lives are structured around, right? We live lives. We do things. And so what is the end that we're doing things toward? We're not just disembodied minds. We don't just live in the realm of theory. There's always a driving principle or principles that practically structures our lives. What are we living towards? And these people in Ephesus had a teaching that was very interested in the abstract, but neglected the practical. And so the gap was filled with kind of what seems like a default. Maybe I'm filling in some gaps here, but kind of seems like a default. It's personal gain. What can I get out of it? And in the end, devotion to God was subordinated to the pursuit of wealth. It's kind of like lame, right? It's like this beautiful picture of all these great, you know, this pursuit of Jesus, godliness, and in the end, that end gets neglected. They're just into the theory, and what becomes the practical end of their lives? Getting rich. Before Paul kind of tackles this pursuit head on, though, he makes sure to note that there is indeed great gain in godliness. The greatest gain, eternal gain, but not material gain. And in fact, he says that we can't actually appreciate this gain that godliness brings unless this our godliness is paired with contentment. In other words, we can't use this devotion to God as a sort of a means to a different end. He's like, no. We have to say, yeah, I want to be devoted to God, and I can be content in the other areas, actually, so that I can pursue this area. So let's read again from verse six. Of course, there is great gain in godliness combined with contentment. For we brought nothing into the world so that we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we'll be content with these. But those who want to be rich fall into temptation and are trapped by many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, and in their eagerness to be rich, some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pains. So just after our section, Paul's going to give Timothy instructions on how to teach those who are wealthy and how to lead a godly life. So that's kind of a different question, isn't it? In verse 17 to 19, he says, "As for those who in the present age are rich, command them not to be haughty or to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but rather on God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. They're to do good, to be rich in good works, generous and ready to share, thus storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of the life that is really life." That's what Paul says to Timothy, that's how you instruct a rich Christian. That's how you live. But here, it's kind of a different topic. It's the desire to become wealthy. It's the desire to get rich that's in view. The pursuit of money, making wealth the goal. Three times this kind of language is used. Verse 9, those who want to be rich. Verse 10, the love of money. And again in verse 10, eagerness to be rich. This desire, love, and eagerness for wealth stands in clear contrast to the kind of contentment that Paul was talking about. Paul says, if we have food and clothing, we have all that we need in respect to material good. I think there's a contemporary author who's maybe contextualized this for the North and says, we better add shelter in there as well. It's pretty cold up here. If we're content with what we've received, though, we're able to make God-centeredness the driving and structuring factor of our lives and our decisions, and experience the eternal gain it brings. But if, on the other hand, we make our own gain, whether that's financial or otherwise, if we make that the driving and structuring factor of our lives, then devotion to God inevitably becomes subordinated to it. It's a means to that other end that we're pursuing. As Jesus wisely and famously said, no one can serve two masters. For a slave will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. So I think the question for each of us this morning is, what's the driving factor of your life, of our lives? What determines most of our decisions? What can't be discarded? What are we not content without? The teaching of Jesus isn't just about these kind of truths that we learn. The teaching of Jesus calls us into an all-encompassing way of life. It's a teaching that's big enough to encompass every single aspect of our lives. And I know, most of us here, we're not like, early Reformation scholastics, writing down all these particulars. But in different ways, we can feel this, right? Where we just say, hey, this is where Christianity belongs in my life, but we can neglect to put it in other parts of our lives. And then we end up, as a default, pursuing something else. Maybe wealth, maybe something else. And so I don't want you to hear me wrong, though, in all of this. This isn't like a works righteousness message that Martin Luther would be very upset with. The message isn't do all these things perfectly and God will accept you. Not at all. The message is Jesus has died for you when we were still helpless, when we were still sinners. Christ died for us, rose to life to free us from old ways that lead to death. Or maybe like Paul says in this passage, ruin and destruction, and to bring us into new life. And sometimes we can just forget that this life that Jesus brings us is big enough to encompass all we do. And we can settle for another default aim of life. And if we neglect to pursue the teaching of Jesus in its whole life application, then we will pursue something else in those areas. And it could be something that would plunge us into ruin and destruction. It's not a question of bringing our perfection to God and saying, look at me. It's a question of pursuit in response to what Jesus has done. What pursuit is driving your life? What pursuit is structuring the practical, everyday questions of life? Or maybe to put it in less stark terms, pulled back a little bit, is there a pursuit that's slowly pushing its way into our lives as we forget that the pursuit of Jesus and his way has relevance for our whole lives. For some of us, it might be wealth. We definitely live in an era, a country, whatever you want to say, society, where the default kind of is financial success. That's kind of what we automatically, you know, judge success by. It's kind of what's assumed to be the structuring factor of life. And so it's probably worthwhile to pause and consider and ask ourselves if maybe we're making this the structuring factor of our lives, consciously or unconsciously. And then maybe to be freed from the obligation, like, it doesn't actually have to. And actually, there's a better structuring factor. There's a better pursuit of our lives. For some of us, the draw might be something different. Not wealth, but something that could still fit into this kind of broader category of personal gain. It could be something like popularity or status, achievement, power. And so, whatever the case, I think for most of us, maybe we're like, this it's not my whole life is in pursuit of this, but maybe we can feel some things pushing their way in, some different pursuits. And so I want to finish this morning by looking at what Paul calls Timothy to. He says, hey, yeah, don't make this your pursuit, but this is what you can pursue. These are the pursuits of the teaching of Jesus. Verse 11, as for you, man of God, shun all this, pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, endurance, and gentleness. These aren't a means to an end. They're the end that we pursue in Jesus. And I want to finish this morning by just kind of looking at each of these words. So righteousness is the first one. Righteousness is a huge word that is used in a ton of different ways throughout the New Testament. Here it's probably just being used broadly to talk about like upright living, a moral life that is upstanding. This is to be the pursuit of the man of God, Timothy, and the pursuit of all of us who would want to follow Jesus. Again, this isn't about earning something. It's about, hey, we've been brought into this new life, so let's pursue the life that Jesus has called us to. We don't pursue righteousness as if we could achieve it on our own merits, but receiving the forgiveness we have because of Jesus' death, we pursue his righteousness by the power of his Spirit and in light of his resurrection, knowing that the goal of our lives is to be like Jesus and see him as he is. And I think in the context of our passage, prioritizing righteousness means that doing what is right is more important than getting a good deal or making good money or being noticed or getting praised. Because righteousness is more valuable. I love what Jesus says in the Beatitudes in his Sermon on the Mount, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Pursuit of righteousness. Godliness, this is the word we've been talking about a lot, so let's hit on it kind of briefly. It means devotion to God. We talk about, you know, a relationship with God, time spent just in prayer, devotion to God. It's kind of a catch-all term, though. It kind of refers to all this stuff that we're talking about. The pursuit that Timothy is encouraged toward is a pursuit of God, to make Jesus the master of our lives and our relationship with him the structuring factor of our lives, period. I love some of the songs we were singing this morning, just pointed that. I surrender to every command. Jesus, I want to know you. I want to know your way. It's about the person above all. So that's the kind of catch-all. The pursuit of godliness prioritizes God above every other factor. And it's challenging because we have so many things vying for our time and attention. But all of these things need to be subordinated to our relationship with God in really practical ways. Faith. This week in our class, we read the book of Hebrews together out loud. It was really cool. We just like read it all. It's a luxury, I know, but it's really sweet that we just got to sit there together and read this out loud in community. One of my favorite, this chapter is full of different kind of descriptions of faith. One of my favorite that I've mentioned here, but hey, do it again. Verses 13 to 16 of Hebrews 11. All of these people died in faith without having received the promises, but from a distance they saw and greeted them. They confessed that they were strangers and foreigners on the earth. For people who speak in this way make it clear that they're seeking a homeland. If they'd been thinking of the land that they'd left behind, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Indeed, he has prepared a city for them. Faith is living with the kind of gain that godliness brings as something that's more real than the gain that we see in this life. Pursue faith, Paul says. People with faith can be content without wealth or prestige or, you know, fill in the blank, because they know that their reward is with God. They see this gain of godliness clearly, and so they can live out this contentedness that Paul says. So Paul tells Timothy, pursue this life of faith. Love. You know, 1 Corinthians 13 famously states that if we had all the gifts of God, but we didn't have love, we would have nothing. The pursuit of love contrasts the pursuit of gain at a pretty core level, because love is a lot more concerned with giving than getting. John 3:16, you know, famous verse, God so loved the world that he gave his only son. And later in the Gospel of John, Jesus will tell his disciples, no one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. So the pursuit of love means the pursuit of laying ourselves down for other people, giving of ourselves to others. Love means compassion, seeing other people, sacrifice, generosity. In other words, it looks like the opposite of a pursuit of our own gain. Pursue love. Pursue endurance, patience, persistence, consistency in the face of obstacles. Endurance is important because our tendency is to turn back to the pursuit of our own gain in some form or fashion when things get difficult. And sometimes things get difficult, really difficult. And a lack of endurance, when that happens, says, I'm done. Just throw in the towel. I'm just going to go back to this other thing. So pursue endurance. A verse that I've been reflecting on lately is James 5:11. Where James says, brothers and sisters, and as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we count as blessed those who have persevered. You've heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. And that's true, right? We look at these people who have endured and we think, wow, look at their character. Look at their life. Look at how they've been formed to people of faithfulness even through trouble. But when we face the stuff, we don't always want to endure. We want to be like, I don't know, it's too much work. So Paul tells Timothy, pursue endurance. And gentleness, finally. I like that Paul lands there. Pursue gentleness. You know, so evidently, the people that Paul's talking about in Ephesus didn't have the quality of gentleness. The words he uses to describe them are conceit, controversy, disputes, envy, dissension, slander, base suspicions. They're focused on their own gain, and it leads them to, battle, I guess. Animosity, competition. This is what James writes again in James 4:1-3. Those conflicts and disputes among you, where do they come from? Do they not come from your cravings that are at war within you? You want something and you don't have it, so you commit murder. And you covet something and cannot obtain it, so you engage in disputes and conflicts. You don't have because you don't ask, and you ask and don't receive because you ask wrongly in order to spend what you get on your pleasures. And this ties back to what Paul says about contentment. Contentment has a different way. It's immune to these battles, and so it can be gentle. And gentleness is such a beautiful and actually powerful thing. It doesn't look powerful, but it is. Contentment doesn't need to accumulate money or things, so it doesn't fight others for them. It doesn't need power or status either, so it doesn't need to prove itself. Contentment leads to gentleness. So, flee all these things and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, endurance, and gentleness. Beautiful. I think the pursuit of those things should be able to occupy us pretty thoroughly in most aspects of our lives. Obviously, there's a whole Bible God's given us and his way. But it should be able to inform every area of our lives, even that list. And I know it's a battle. I feel the pull of different kinds of gain on my own life and how I structure my own life. But when I make those things the end that I pursue, it's wasted energy. And it ends up subordinating all these beautiful things: godliness, righteousness, faith, love, endurance, gentleness. Puts those under these really lame things, like my own gain. So I know that none of us are gonna walk out of here perfectly righteous, perfectly godly, totally full of faith, perfectly loving, enduring all things perfectly and completely gentle. But the word that I want us to leave with is pursuit. I think we could walk out of here this morning with the pursuit of those things being more central to our lives than the pursuit of wealth or other gains. And I know it's a battle, but this is a reminder again this morning. What is the end? What is the pursuit that's driving our lives? The practical decisions, everyday decisions of our life. What is central? Is it personal gain? Is it wealth? Is it whatever else? Or is it the godliness that Jesus calls us to, devotion to God, in expressed in these ways we've talked about? So we're gonna have some time to reflect. Obviously, lots of different things have been said this morning, and so we like to finish our service just with some time to bring it to the Holy Spirit. Say, Holy Spirit, what would you have me to do? I wanna hear your voice more than Ben's voice. I wanna hear your voice. I've heard your word. Speak to my heart now and bring up something. Maybe this morning, what's a particular practical area of my life that's begun to pursue a goal, decisions I've made that have begun to pursue a goal that's different than knowing Jesus and following his way.